I'm Dave. I'm a regional organiser for the IWW, which stands for Industrial Workers of the World. It's a union based on anti-capitalism, based on grassroots democracy, and based on organising workplaces and giving people the ability to organise and do stuff for themselves rather than building a bureaucracy or officials or whatever to do things for them, like in mainstream trade unions. We organise on industrial scale, so that means what we do is we don't organise trades like a trade union does. We organise across an industry. So the example that we use to explain that is basically that in a hotel, for example, cleaners, front of house, so like the receptionist, and then the cooks, for example, would all technically be in different unions. I mean, now it's not exactly working like that anymore because a lot of sort of trade unions do organise on industry, but essentially that's what trade unionism is. But we'd organise as a hotel, so the whole building. And it's based around the principle of an injury to one is an injury to all, and that you all organise to protect each other, basically. But yeah, that's me. This programme that I've been doing, because I've done it a few times now, is still getting developed, so and there's a lot to cover. Basically, your workplace rights, I mean, it's a massive, massive subject and really, really convoluted and really, really complicated because it's based on a lot of law and it changes a lot and it's been tampered with, it's been, you know, rights have been won, rights have been lost, so it can be very dry at some points and at other times it's useful stuff anyway. And then the organising discussion is much more entertaining because you're actually talking about different tactics that you can use and things like that. What I'd like to do, if people are alright with it, is kind of go around and people can say what they'd like to get out of the discussion and stuff like that, if that's cool. Cool.
I'm Del, and I'm hoping to get some pointers on how to start unionising my fellow work colleagues and getting them a bit better organised and not relying on the current unions that they may be affiliated to, and actually organising for themselves.
I'm Fiona, just looking for an introduction really. I mean, I work for a company and I've just been asked to do some work around myself employed, so I really just want to know a bit more about how to take myself.
Yeah, cool.
What would you say?
Just introduce yourself and say what you'd like to get out of the discussion, if that's cool.
Alright, yeah. Hi, I'm Eve. Just learn more about workplace rights.
Yeah, it's another kind of situation where you just a kind of outline introduction to something I didn't know very much about.
Cool.
I'm Hazel. I'm studying to be a social worker at the moment, so I'm kind of interested in how like that side of things fits into stuff, and also that I've generally found trade unions in the past very like male dominated spaces and historically quite sexist, and just like how that would come into like a new kind of more radical way of looking at things and bringing gender issues into it.
I'm just sort of interested in trade unions, basically. I want a sort of introduction to how is it
happening. I'm Rich. I've been a T&G and Unite steward for the last 10-12 years for my sins, but I'm a Walklin as well. So I don't know, I just thought I'd come along, this would seem like an interesting meeting. Cool. See what was what.
I'm Dunya. I was a GMB member for a bit and a steward, but it'd be good to learn about alternatives because you only get the main ones really promoted at your work.
I'm Pete. I've mostly just done climate change activism and no borders activism, but I'm going to put my energy into union activism. Just to find out how it all links together.
Thanks, Mark.
Hi, I'm Alan. I work in the public sector. We've just had a round of redundancies. I'd be interested in knowing how we can prepare and work against these things when they come around in the next 6 months or so again.
Yeah. I'm Chris, UCU member, an IWW member, and I'm also the Sheffield branch secretary. So here to the discussions already.
As of Tuesday.
Yeah, yeah, branch secretary as of Tuesday.
Cool, brilliant. Right, as I said, the workplace rights stuff can be very dry. But what I've put together, and what I wanted to print off, but I kind of realised it was going to cost me a fortune, because it's actually like, it's 33 pages long, this booklet that I've put together. So what I was going to suggest, if people would like a copy of it, I could take emails and send it out. Yeah, I've tried to put together a pretty solid list of your rights at work and information on it and stuff, and different sources and things that you can look at. But what I'd like to first sort of talk through is how best to understand workplace law. Basically, what I always say with understanding your rights at work is that you've got to know the basics and just be solid on the basics, because what you'll find is most bosses actually don't know that much about employment law, and that you can actually push them around as far as employment law goes. If you know the basics better than them, then you can essentially win an argument hands down. So what you need to do is you need to get to grips with the basics. And basically, you want to split them into a few different categories. Okay, so what the first thing, and what's very important these days as well, is understanding your contract. And your actual employment status. So, for example, you would say you're self-employed, right? You know, they say you're self-employed, but technically you're actually not, and that if it came down to it, you would actually be counted as something else. So, you know, it's important to understand how that works. So, pay, hours and time off as well. A lot of people, time off particularly, a lot of people either don't understand their rights around it, or just think, oh well, I have to work, so that, you know. But ultimately, we do have a lot of strength in those sort of three areas, and you can push things on those. And then next, your rights as an individual. So that's things about sort of discrimination and other things like that as well. And then your collective union rights and industrial action as well. that's really important to understand if you want to build in a workplace as well, if you want to organise with your colleague, with your fellow workers and stuff. Then the industrial action bit, again, that is a particularly convoluted area of law, because there's so many ins and outs of it that have been messed with over one government after another. Then I've got some stuff on this, to be fair, so this isn't something you have to know, but it really helps, and it's fighting the bosses, I'll put it down as, and basically nicked it off an excellent flyer that where did we get it from? Do you
remember? Which one?
The Fire Your Boss one.
Oh, Lincoln, I think.
Yeah. And it's different tactics and different ways that you can put pressure on your bosses basically at work. And then some of the other stuff as well that is important to look at is disciplinary and grievance procedure. That can be a ridiculously dry part of law. I mean, pulling your hair out dry is fucking terrible. But it's important, and most of the worst thing is about stuff like that as well, is most of it isn't even law. Most of it's sort of guidelines and best practices and stuff like that. But if you know the best practices, you can go, well, you shouldn't be doing it like that. There's better way, you know. And you can try and push things like that. And then lastly as well, end of employment and whether it's fair or not as well. That's something that's quite important. And if you do start sticking up for people at work and stuff, that can be a really important one. And again, that's an equally convoluted bit as well, because it has a lot of stuff in there that's been altered. So, for example, For a long time, it's been there's sort of time limits and stuff on when you can claim afterwards that you've been unfairly dismissed. And then there's certain things that have been added to it that mean they don't have to be within that time limit. And the list is massive, you know, because it's been altered through. Because obviously the form of British law is that it's built on case law. So what you find is that something's been standard practice for years and years and years, and then a particular case comes along and it breaks with that tradition, and then the whole legal system around that particular issue has to change. So because of the liquid form of British law and the way it works, is you have to be constantly aware of that, and it makes it a very difficult thing, especially if you get to areas where you're actually going to be representing people in tribunals. What you actually find is that you end up having to have a massive pile of books, and a new one comes out like every 6 months or something like that. So it can be a ridiculous process, basically. And then the more interesting stuff is organising, different tactics on organising. So what we say with this one is the TUC actually produced a really good booklet, and it's called it's just like an organising booklet. Although obviously what we'll do is we'll pull that apart as well, because there's a lot of problems with it, and it's obviously based around having full-time officials, paid officials, things like that, which obviously there's a problem with, but we can discuss that when we get to it. So is there anything in particular that people want to discuss out of that list, or did I move through it too quickly and people can't remember what I said?
why don't we cover holiday, sick pays,
yeah,
and contracts. That tends to be the most common one.
In that case, well, we've got an activity that's a good one to start on that. right, so basically, what you both might know a bit about this anyway, but what I kind of want people to discuss, if it's cool, is what you think a contract is. What you think it means, and who can change it, who has power and ownership over that contract. If anyone's got any input or ideas what a contract is.
I thought I knew, but you're scaring me now.
go on.
Just a sort of a written agreement between the worker and the boss, of sort of what they can do, what they will and what they might be fine for, whatever might be paid.
And who do you think has rights to change that or alter it?
Well, once it's been signed, I didn't really think that you were really able to alter it that much. I mean, what examples would you give that sort of...
Well, I mean, for example, do you think a boss can change it easily? Or...
No.
Right, yeah.
I don't think
so. You're quite right. the first bit, though, I mean, this is the interesting thing about contract law in this country. I mean, in France, they have to give you a contract. Law states you have to get a contract. In this country, you have no legal right to a contract. We've looked into it in detail because we
after 90 days they're obliged to give you a contract.
No, it's 28 after 28 days they have to give you a real list of rights and responsibilities and things like that. It's responsibilities and I can't remember the exact wording of it, but essentially, it's like a bullet-pointed version of your contract, but they don't actually have to give you the piece of paper that's your contract. I always thought that you had to get a contract, but there's no statute and no legal right for you to demand a contract from. But you have to get this responsibilities thing, and so basically that will give you what you have to do, and it'll give you things that. If you do wrong, you'll get sacked for, basically, on there. To put it basically, right? And you can demand that after 28 days. So in your particular example, being self-employed, that's very important. Because it really helps to know exactly where you stand when you're self-employed, particularly when you're self-employed. Obviously, in any other workplace as well, the same goes, but I would definitely suggest it. Get hold of that as quickly as possible. Far as it being on a piece of paper as well, that isn't true either. That what it actually is just standard practice, basically. A contract can be made up of what just generally happens on a day-to-day basis. If for a year, you've been working for a company for 2 years, and over those 2 years you've had your break has been an hour and 5 minutes. And then the boss comes in and goes, well, everyone's got to have an hour break now. That would be breaking with your contract. Even though it never been written down, never been discussed, never been said. If that's just what's done and that's standard practice, you can essentially argue for that as standard and practice, basically, is the word that comes up in the law a lot. So if in your workplace something is done on a regular basis and always is that, it gives you a footing to turn around and go, but we've always done it like this. So that's standard and practice, and so it has to be carried on like that. And that is essentially your non-verbal contract, basically. So a contract can be verbal, non-verbal, it can be written, non-written. British law is very open to interpretation on this subject, and you can use it to your advantage, but unfortunately that means the boss can use it to their advantage as well, because it means if something's shit at your job and it always has been shit, well then they can argue it's going to continue to be shit. So it does work both ways. It means you can defend positive things, but it means they can defend negative things as well. So you just have to be aware of that when you're working around the issue of the contract and stuff.
You know, you were talking about who can change the contract. Because where I was working before, it was a charity, and obviously the cuts affected blah, blah, blah. So they wanted to change the terms and conditions for all of the staff, reduce the salaries, reduce the maternity leave, reduce the holiday. And it all went out to consultation with the union, but they pretty much put it through anyway.
Yeah.
So is there like a time scale?
Basically, when they change a contract or when they start change standard practices, basically they have to consult with it. If there's a recognised union, even if you're not in it, that union decides whether that contract's going to be passed or not, which can be a very unfortunate state of affairs, especially if you are not associated with that union or you don't want to be a member of that union for whatever reason. For example, in Showroom Cinema, when they brought Bechtel in, which is a mainstream trade union there, if they wanted to change contracts, as long as that union signed off on it, well then that's kind of tough. You know, you don't necessarily get a say in it, because that union is recognised to represent your voice, even if you have no involvement in it whatsoever. If there isn't a recognised union, they have to basically get you to sign off on it as an individual. They can't change the contract without talking to you. You have to be fully consulted and you have to be involved in the process.
We got, because it's happened to me twice now, and they, the way they got around it was they served us all a 13 weeks notice, and said if you can basically have a job, but it's with this new contract.
Yeah, they do that a lot. Yeah.
You banged the council earlier this year.
Yeah, that's where that's where it was.
Yeah, that is a tactic they use to get around it. Equally, with something like that, that's where you come to like a fighting attitude towards it instead, because I guess the issue is mainstream trade unions would turn around and go, oh, we need to negotiate about this and stuff like that. Personally, my opinion would be that you'd all turn around, all together, collectively turn around and go, all right then, we'll take you up on that notice, that's fine. And basically use it as an opportunity to turn around and say, well, fuck you. If you're going to turn around and rip up our contract, then fair enough. But still, obviously, to keep the job, but just at the same time, all present the attitude that right, we'll quit them, because they'd be fucked if everyone took them up on that offer. They won't be able to continue, you know. They'd essentially have to close down for weeks on end to get new staff in and train them and everything like that. So,
but what would you do in a situation where there was a union representation and the word, you know, the decision of the union is out, you know, what the outcome would be? So you're in the minority, and you don't agree with what the union are deciding, so you're a bit screwed in that situation. How do you? I
tore up my GMB membership for that kind of attitude that you get in mainstream trade unions like that. And I think that's why it's important to organise upwards instead of downwards. Yeah. So you know, I think in those kind of situations, exactly, that's where your grassroots involvement is so important, because the problem is if you've got these bureaucrats and you've got these full time officials, they will make those decisions for you. Or in the case of fellow worker over in Lincoln, used to be a postie, basically what they did is they, because set up in such a way that the union hierarchy has to sign off if you even want a meeting at work. They have to sign off on allowing you to have a meeting. So you're welcome to come in if you want. They're up there, love. Straight up the stair. that was CWU, and they basically didn't allow any of the workers to meet up and actually discuss these contractual changes, and then just said, oh yeah, it's the best way forward, we've got to agree to it, and then that was it. It was just done, and it was agreed to, and since then CWU have been hemorrhaging members because of that exact reason. And the problem is, you're just going to alienate people doing that kind of thing, aren't you?
I mean, I'm a UCU member, so like education workers, you pretty much have to join the trade union that's there. But yeah, you kind of have to accept that in a lot of public sector work particularly, you kind of need to fight on two fronts. Like, you need to fight the buses, but equally you need to fight the union, unfortunately.
The union buses.
Yeah. And I think in that situation, dual carding has a benefit. Because you can, as someone who's like a militant worker, you can make a difference in trade union meetings by arguing for more militant approaches. But then there's also value in having that kind of, you know, IWW structure within there. Like in the IWW, there's a very large section of education workers, so we can all talk about not only what's happening in our workplace, but what we think of what NUT or UCU are doing, and how we can kind of try and push them towards taking a more militant stance. So, yeah, in lots of situations, I would say just being an IWW member, particularly in like ununionised places, is enough. But dual carding can have its benefits and pressurising the trade union.
In any of those circumstances, there's always going to be a minority of other people who agree with you that the union leadership's agreements is bullshit. Mm-hmm. And so it's actually, you know, it's trying to find a way to find them and to see if you can actually become an organised like subgroup within the union. And they're in unison, the council unison at the moment, there's group, because the council leadership is just utterly shit. Mm-hmm. And just wants to go along and agree with everything the Labour Council's doing, because that's what they do. Mm-hmm. And so, you know,
they're future Labour councillors, aren't they?
That's absolutely. Or in some cases, present Labour councillors.
Oh, even
but, you know, so there's a small, you know, it's only, there's 10,000, 6,000 unison members in the council, and there's what, about 30 of the organised oppositionists. But they're actually forcing at least the leadership to respond and to come up with things, to at least outdo them and to push them a little bit further. And by doing that, at least you're finding other people who will, maybe not this time, but next time, be able to challenge those union bureaucrats to, maybe challenge them for the position, actually for their seats, or just actually challenge them to do something a bit more radical. And because sometimes it becomes really obvious, it's at the moment, unison has been trying to step down on anybody doing any anti-cuts organising, because that's a bit too lefty, and now they've suddenly gone, fuck, we need to get a ballot out to actually win this strike, and we've told everybody not to do anything, to go along with everything. So eventually, those tactics screw themselves over, and hopefully in unison again, that will become obvious shortly. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, yeah, it's just a bloody long process. Mm-hmm.
Definitely, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Right, yeah, I guess what we'll talk about next is your employment status. So this bit is basically, this is quite a constantly changing thing, because the situation for agency workers changed about a week and a half ago, so that has very recently been updated. But there is a list, right, we'll go through this, there's a list of things, essentially questions you need to ask yourselves, and if you basically answer a certain amount of these, it's an arbitrary amount as well, it's not an arbitrary amount, I mean it can change, and it's a very grey area, like most of labour law just is generally just grey and jet, like all over. So but if you satisfy a fair amount of them, then you can essentially say that you're employed by someone rather than self-employed or an agency worker or whatever, because they will they will very often try and write you off as not an employee, because if you're an employee, then you have a lot more rights. They have to give you certain holiday benefits, everything else, you know. So, right. So, you need to ask yourself whether you're engaged to perform work as an employee. So, what that means, are you carrying out work that's a central part of a company? So if you form a really central part of the structure of the company, well, you know, you can say that you're employed, pretty much. Are you working under direct control of your boss? So are they the person straight above you, and do they have to give you stuff to do? Do they have, regardless of whether there is anything to do, do they have to find something for you to do? Do you have to do the work, or can you turn around and say you don't feel like doing it, or you're not interested? Or so if you were properly self-employed, then you could turn around and go, actually no, I don't want to do that work today. I want to go in and feel, you know. So can you pass the work on to someone else? So can you subcontract it, basically? Does the company supply the gear that you use? So do they supply a uniform or tools, things like that? Do you work only for that company? Because if you're only working for one company, that's quite important, because then it's harder for them to argue that you're self-employed. Have you worked for the same company for a long period of time as well? If you've been working for a company for a long period of time, after a certain amount of time, you're essentially employed by them anyway. Even if, for agency workers now, it does have a fixed date on it, so it's a 12-week period. If you're working over that 12-week period, you are then officially employed by that person. Regardless of what they say, regardless if they continue to call you an agency worker, you are officially employed by that person, and you have the same rights as everyone else who works there. Are you paid a regular wage, and is it taxed by that company as well? The financial issue can be quite central here as well. So if you get a pay slip from that company and your tax is deducted straight off that, then that's quite a central plank of you being employed by that company as well. And lastly, do you get company benefits? So do you get holiday time from that company, stuff like that? If you get stuff like that as well, that can form a central plank of your argument about saying that you, whether you're employed or not. And like I say, by arguing that you're employed, if they've tried to keep you into a status that you're not, you can bring a lot of things up. So you can basically get a lot more rights out of them, and you can argue for a lot more. Right. And it's important to remember that even if your boss is telling you that you're not employed, if you basically answered yes to a fair few of those questions, then no matter what they say, you're an employee of that company. No matter how many times they try and tell you that you're not, you are, and you have just as many rights as everyone else who works there. Obviously there's a lot of different categories of workers. You've got agency workers, which I don't know if anyone here has done agency work or basically, now that the situation's improved drastically for agency workers as of the 1st of October, because now you have day one rights and you have to be treated equally, you have to get equal treatment for everyone who works there. Unfortunately, that doesn't cover everything, but you do have a lot more rights now anyway. So yeah, and then you've got contract staff and consultants. So basically, if you're contracted in to do one particular job for a set period of time, office holders, right, this includes people like police, military, prison officers, and basically by being an office holder, that's how they legally speaking, bobbies and everyone else aren't allowed to have a union, because as an office holder, you don't have a right to a union. It even includes politicians and things like that as well. So if you're... It's meant to mean, originally meant, anyway, someone who was voted into a position. So someone who was granted that particular position. But yeah, it's been a way to not allow you unionism in those particular industries. Although you still have associations and things like that. That in some cases, like the prison officers particularly, has come to actually act like a union anyway. And pretty much does the same thing. I mean, they're actually going out on strike on the 30th of November, so they are, for all intents and purposes, they are, but they're not. Right, partners. This is if you're a partner in a company, you don't have as many rights to representation and things like that. It becomes more of a legal issue. But things to be aware of if you do find yourself in that situation is you can be what's called a paid partner, which essentially would mean you have all the same rights as an employee. Because that would include, for example, like a lawyer who'd become a partner in a company, in a firm, sorry, and was still getting paid. That would essentially mean, as long as you've got bosses above you, you would essentially still be a paid employee. You'd be described as a paid partner, basically. Trainees. This is an area where you can get quite badly treated. So a lot of companies, when they call people trainees, they're trying to get off without paying you. I came across one particular example recently, and representing her actually at the minute, and she'd been working for a company for about 4 weeks, and they were saying she was a trainee, so they didn't have to pay her. Actually, regardless of whether you're a trainee or not, they still have to pay you. Certain companies, so if you're doing an apprenticeship, for example, or the government in particular, if you're an employee of the government, can pay you a much smaller rate, allowed under law for things like apprenticeships. To encourage companies to do apprenticeships, they get that you can be paid a much smaller amount, so like $2.83 an hour or something as a trainee. But that's a very limited list. So unless the company you're working for is on that very limited list, then they can't do that. And they have to pay you the same wage as they pay everyone else from day one, from the second you walk in the door. They have to start paying you a proper wage.
So a list of companies that are paying, showing trainees that low wage, right? What counts as that list of companies? What types of them?
It would literally be the state, or someone who is doing an apprenticeship. An apprenticeship would have to be, you'd essentially, it's weird because you're essentially still employed by the state as an apprentice, because the state's writing, the government's writing off on those apprenticeships.
But if you're on a scheme, isn't it?
Yeah, because you're on a scheme. So then that's allowed. But that is basically limited to being written off by government. That's probably going to expand massively now, especially with the kind of the work plans that they're putting out for unemployed people and stuff like that. I imagine that list is probably going to get much bigger soon. So that's something to be aware of. But it is a very limited list, and 99.9% of companies aren't going to be allowed to do it at the minute. Okay. But that is something to be aware of.
It's where I'm working at the moment. Yeah. We laid off 8 people.
Yeah.
Replacing with 4 people and 4 they regraded onto a lower salary scale,
right.
And then the other 4 that they got back, they have 4 trainees now who are paid this £2.73 an hour,
right?
On fixed term 1-year contracts,
right? You need to make sure they're actually on a government scheme, basically. If they're on a government scheme, then unfortunately it's allowed, but if they're not, then they simply can't get away with that wage. I mean, it depends how old. Are they quite young?
Yeah, they're 16 to 18, I think.
Right, yeah.
But I don't think the age is, I think it's I think there is some scheme thing going on as well, like, yeah. Some evil scheme.
Yeah, definitely, not kidding.
Well, yeah, I think you'd feel a lot more of that going on.
Yeah, definitely, because it's cheap labour, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely.
Companies will be taking advantage of that more, especially with the government sort of language that it's using at the minute. Right, okay. Contract law. It's literally the most simply boring thing we can ever discuss. But it's important, alright? Like we discussed before, it's not necessarily a piece of paper. And what is important as well to remember is what constitutes a breach of contract. There's two terms here. There's breach of express terms and breach of implied terms. The difference here is, if it's an express term, they've actually gone up, they've gone and they've broken an exact something that's exactly worded in your contract, or is changing standard practice. Okay? breach of implied terms is basically, it's a more vague concept, and it's the phrase here is breaching mutual trust and confidence. Okay, and what that means is an employee or an employer feels like the other has broken that trust by a particular action. It may not be something that's written down in the contract, as you can't do. Funnily enough, actually, included in this would be like nicking from your boss. That would actually be, because that's not, no contract is ever going to write in it, you cannot steal from your boss. It's just implied, you know, you can't, legally speaking, you cannot steal from your boss. And that is breaking mutual trust. But it can include a lot more than that, you know, like, if, for example, you know, it has been used by unions in the past, actually, to argue that management, and to pass things like votes of no confidence in management and things like that, and then has been given a legal weight, that vote has been given a legal weight, because it's felt that it's an example of management breaking mutual trust and confidence through whatever actions, so just bad management, for example, could be considered a breach of implied.
So how do you feel about things like Steal from Work Day then, which is a group of people try to set up in the US? Does that, like,
I think that's a very positive thing. Okay. Obviously, I would not suggest it legally speaking, but yes, definitely. I actually bumped into a guy when it was the last lot of public sector strikes, and we were going around as like IWW sort of supporting people, and we gave out some flyers and stuff, and I got talking to this one guy, and he was like, oh, I used to work at Peterborough, which is where I work, and he goes to me, oh, it's good that you're unionising there, it's like the most political thing we ever did, was just steal everything that wasn't nailed down. So, you know, it can be a good way to get back at the boss, but you may have a bit of trouble legally speaking if you get caught.
Could it endanger any kind of contract issue between bosses and... It could, yeah. You could
be fired straight away without any questions if they can prove it, but the difficult thing is they have to show a lot of evidence. I mean, if CCTV footage is obviously enough, but if you're representing someone who's been accused of stealing, the best thing you can do is just go in and just disprove their argument. I would personally say make sure the person you're representing never admits to it, unless there's like massively outweighing evidence. Then you might as well just pack your bags and go home, because there's nothing you can do about that.
But where's the line between it being a criminal offence and it being a political thing?
I think that's a personal issue, I guess, isn't it? You know. Depends how bad your boss is, I guess. Yeah, if you just work for a little company and they're struggling to get by, then probably not. But if you work for a big corporation, then fucking go for it. I don't know. It's personal choice, I guess, isn't it? But yeah, I mean, if you are representing someone who's been accused of stealing from work, the most important thing you need to do is just go in and argue that it's not true. Because the second that you admit that's true, or the second you admit that that's happened, then that's it. There is no argument that you can make against it. Because that is the pure example of breach of implied trust. And then that's game over, unfortunately.
You're generally right and your point is right. But I mean, there are always arguments you can make.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Yeah.
If you're a long standing employee, oh, terrible breach of, you know, one off blah blah blah. Mm. So I mean, I'm not generally disagreeing, but there's always an argument.
You should never write it off. Right. Sorry, I shouldn't have said that, actually. No, you're right. You should never write it off. If you can, I would suggest go in there and argue your arse off that it was a mistake, I won't do it again, you know. I wasn't stealing, I was liberating. Yeah, exactly.
No, thank you.
But if you know, you can try and argue that, focus maybe on the mistake thing and say, oh, you know, didn't realise it was nicking, or, you know, was just going to borrow it and bring it back tomorrow or something like that, you know. I mean, obviously, it depends
on
if it is. If you, yeah, exactly. If it's a massive bag of cash, then, you know, you might have an issue there, you know. But you can try, and you should always go in and argue. But I mean, that kind of brings us something that's quite important as well, actually, as far as representing people at work and helping out your fellow workers and stuff. Never forget, any meeting with management, regardless of how trivial it sounds, and regardless of how much they go, oh, it's just a little chart, we're just having a little chart, these are the ways that management put pressure on people. These little chats, you know, these little meetings, oh, oh, it's just a little discussion. Always make sure, anytime anyone has a meeting with management, or anyone goes into any kind of discussion with management, always make sure there's a minimum of two people. If at all possible, fill the room. We had our area manager come down and talk to us. He was just expecting me to walk into him, but instead we just brought the crowd and filled the office with as many people as we could get hold of to get come down. That is always the best tactic. Never leave anyone on their own with management where possible, because at the end of the day, that is how they scare the shit out of people, and that is how they stop people unionising, they stop people asking for their rights, because it's a scary process. And if your manager comes round and gets you into a room and there's just you and then the manager and the assistant manager or the manager and a HR director or whatever, then they start arguing that what you're saying is wrong, that pressure, 9 times out of 10, is going to scare people out of asking for what they rightfully should have. So anytime, make sure that people are in groups or at least in two, you know.
And make them wait if necessary. If they say, because I've had this before, particularly in the showroom, because this was how someone got unfairly dismissed, that they were just at the end of their shift, they were called into an office and he didn't have a contract, so they went, oh, don't come in tomorrow, and he was on his own. Whereas, if they say, we want to have a discussion, we go, well, I want my union rep here, you're going to have to wait till my union rep is available to sit in on this meeting.
Yeah.
It's perfectly reasonable to say that.
Well, if it's written in the policy and procedures that in a grievance meeting, if you're not part of a union member, you can't bring a fellow workmate in.
Yeah, you have a right to have a workplace colleague. If you're not a union member, or if you don't like the union, or you know you don't like the person who would be your rep, like the shop steward or whatever, by all means take someone else in. You have a right to a workplace colleague to go in with you, and you have a right to a union rep, and you have a right to make them wait as well. Basically, the legal word it is like reasonable allowance or something like that, and there's no actual term on it. So as much time as you need, basically. Generally speaking, as a rule of thumb, a week tends to be the most you can get to wait. But if needs must, then it can be longer. But it's difficult to argue for a longer period of time. But make sure you do, if you need to. It's not a bad thing to ask them to wait. And don't let them pressure you into thinking that it is, because they might just say to you, oh, it's just a little chat, it's only going to take 2 minutes. Tell them, well, I don't feel comfortable doing that. You know, I want my union rep here, or I want my workplace colleague here, or whatever. Make sure that you do that. Because like Chris said, it's a classic way of management putting pressure on people or getting rid of people without a fuss. It's just like little chats. So yeah, always be aware of that when you're in your workplace. Or wherever you are, that you need to keep that as a constant worry.
Are there any requirements for? So I've seen situations where workers have been sacked or asked to leave on short notice, and it was for like somebody's come out and then dropped on the table a big log file of everything you've done on the internet in the last like 3 weeks. You know, okay, they just dropped like a watch of paper like this, and it's gone through like, oh, what's this? You know, what's this? And those things are quite hard to respond to if you're not expecting that kind of situation. Somebody comes and drops a big lump of data, a big lump of stuff. Say, well, we've got all this evidence of you being like a useless waster or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, explain yourself.
Yeah. I mean, again, that comes under the reasonable allowance thing. They have to allow for you for time, and your union rep, and your workplace colleague, to go through that data. They can't just drop it in front of you and expect you to instantly know what to do with it. They have to allow for time for you to get look at evidence. They have to present that evidence, and they have to allow both sides. I mean, the same goes for us as representatives as well. You have to give management allowance to look through data or look through whatever. It does. I mean, this is the thing about the law, the legal system. It does work. It works equally both ways, and that's that. Well, it's supposed to. It doesn't, obviously. I mean, what I didn't say at the beginning is what you always have to be when you're aware of when you're looking at the law, is that it does tend to go in favour of the bosses, you know, and that's. That's why, when it comes down to it, organising is the more important thing. And I personally find that as the problem with mainstream trade unionism, is that the focus is legalistic, not based around organising. The focus should be organising, having a strong workplace, having an organised workplace. Because, listen, like, the law will only take you so far. The law will only do so much, right? But at the end of the day, if everyone in your workplace is not even necessarily organised around a union, but if your workplace is organised and you're all mates and you all work together and you all, you know, you all show solidarity to each other, then no matter what your boss does, if they bring out a fucking massive law book that says how many times you've fucked up, well, it doesn't matter, because if you all walk out and just live, then there's nothing they can do about it, you know. If you're organised together,
like the recent example of mine, there's been a few problems at my work, and I'm a UCU member, but no one else really is out of all the other teaching associates. And there was a problem with pay, which we won't go into now, but basically it was kind of going to cause us a lot of bother. So we all just talked to each other about what was going on, and everyone was really angry about it. And this policy that had been brought in, which would cause us huge amounts of problems, after everyone kind of went to the manager and said, like, we're really upset about this, it got overturned in a day. And that wasn't a union that did that. That was the realisation that if the entire workforce is pissed off about something, then they can't, you know, they can't produce the service that they want to. So it's really part of, like, militancy is, yeah, you're right, it's the most powerful thing we can have. And sometimes going outside the confines of that is the right thing to do.
Definitely. Hey, so we'll get back. Sorry, we started half an hour late. Everything's been running late today. So, just a couple of points quickly as well. Important things, little snippets of law that are very helpful. That I meant to mention earlier, but I've kind of forgotten. Right. Your right to rest at work. This is something that a lot of people don't know, or a lot of people are unsure on, right? The work time directive, many bosses will tell you, mine included, that, oh, it's in your contract that you signed out of it, or, we don't use that at our workplace. Every workplace has that as basic, regardless of what they tell you. And you have to sign off on stepping out of the work time directive yourself, and they can't not employ you on the basis that you won't sign off on that. I mean, there is a few exceptions to that, like nursing, and I think police as well. It tends to be like emergency services, but that's allowed for within our law. But work time directive, and it says directive, but it is essentially the law. And in that time, you're allowed. There's three ways of understanding rest. All right, you get your rest breaks, which is 20 minutes for every 6 hours you work, and it is 20 minutes within that 6 hours. You find a lot of workplaces is that they say, "Oh, you've got to work 6 hours and then you have 20 minutes." That's bollocks. It's 20 minutes within those 6 hours. So at some point in those 6 hours, you have to be allowed a 20 minutes break. Daily rest. So basically what that means is you've got to be allowed 11 and a half hours between every shift, right? So when your shift finishes to when your next one starts, you have to be allowed 11 and a half hours to go home, sleep, do whatever you want, right? But you have to be allowed that 11 and a half hours in the law. Weekly rest, right? This is quite a convoluted one, this one, because it is a 48-hour week under this law. But that's worked out on an average over 17 weeks. So say you have 1 week where you work 100 hours and then you don't work for the rest of the 17 weeks, then that's allowed. But it's 48 hours on an average over 17 weeks. Quite like a random arbitrary figure, but it's just the way the legal system works, basically.
How do they work that out with shift work then? Because my shift pattern's always been finish at 11
and
start at 6 or 7, or do a sleep-in
within
that.
Unless you've signed off on that, that's not allowed. They're not allowed to do that. Unless you've look at your contract, because it may have been that you signed it as part of your contract without even realising.
Probably.
Because they sometimes, what they do in contracts now is they put like a little extra signature box and like a little writing, it's saying, you know, you're signing out of the work time directive. And you just fill in your contract when you start a job and you're like, yep. And you've done it without even thinking. But check that, double check that. But they shouldn't do that. And a lot of workplaces actually encourage people to break it without even realising. Sometimes your boss might not even realise that you are allowed that 11 and a half hours. It's like I was saying about knowing the basics. Most of the bosses probably don't know that you're allowed 11 and a half hours. Or sometimes I might just be a wanker and not want you to know. So, but that you're entitled to 11 and a half hours between shifts.
Care work and social work is particularly bad for that. Yeah. My partner's in social work and regularly they won't give you a day off, like a proper day off. And most of the time it's because they don't really know the law. But yeah, you can choose to, even if you have signed it, you can choose to unsign it, if that makes sense. We've noted. Yeah, you need to like press them on it. Because also if you're doing nights, which is quite common for care work, that it still counts as being at work, even if you're just sleeping in the house.
Because you're on call. 25 hour shifts,
yeah.
Because it's supposedly 6 hours
if it's,
you're
asleep.
Yeah.
You're not.
Yeah.
But it's just a way to get like 6 hours paid
for
30 quid
out of it. Yes. Trying to think what else we need to shove in. Yeah, like I say, if anyone wants this booklet, I'm happy to send it out to anyone who wants it. It's got all kinds of stuff in here. I mean, I've got some other stuff in here as well about sort of rights of ex-offenders, dress and appearance at work, stuff like that. Generally, as a rule of thumb, when you're talking about rights as individuals, there's a lot of limits, but the Equalities Act 2011 was actually very good. What it actually means now is bringing all those Equality Acts together, like sex discrimination, race discrimination, all into one act, is that it's actually, what it's done is it's actually widened out the concept of what equality covers, because it actually covers long term illness now as well. So if you have an issue, regardless of what it is, I mean, it might be a bad back, you've got a dodgy leg, you know, whatever, if it's lasted 12 months or longer, the Equalities Act covers it. So as long as it's affected you for 12 months or longer, you're covered under the Equalities Act, and your employer has to make arrangements for you at work, basically. And there is actually a fund that your employer can apply to get up to £1,000 to get equipment to help you at work. So like a more comfortable chair or whatever. As long as something's affected you for 12 months or longer, then that covers you, basically.
Does each person just have that £1,000 for a set amount of time, or could it be
it's to buy equipment. It's only a one-off payment.
It can be a lot more. We're just doing it at work for a bloke he's 55 and just discovered he's dyslexic.
Right.
He's getting £2,000 from the DWP for the equipment and all the training now to use it, and so it's a bit over £2,000. But yeah, I mean, they've been
nice.
I mean, it is just straightforward. As long as you go through the occupational health and everything,
then
the government should pay for anything not.
The £1,000 is the limit that the government will pay, but then anything above that is at the behest of your employer, basically.
Mm.
So the £1,000 is the government grant, and then anything that's added on top of that. But the issue there is for the employer is that that if they don't cough up the money, then they leave themselves open to prosecution of the Equalities Act. So you can make the argument for more money if it's needed, but you have to put a pretty strong argument forward that you need it. You're right.
We might just have gone through absolutely skinned.
Yeah. Yeah, I've got some stuff here as well about Stratlaw, but I'm just really aware that kind of our time's running out, so I might leave that. I don't know. I mean, technically, I guess quarter past one.
Yeah. Should we talk about organising?
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That's what I was thinking we need to do, really. Right. Okay. This one. This should hopefully be a bit lighter. Yeah, sorry, the rep stage one course should be done over an entire day, so it's and even then you're only scratching the surface, so it's hard to kind of try and squeeze it into a short period of time, and regardless it is always a dry subject, so it's, but it's important stuff, and it's good stuff to know, so right, okay, so a famous organiser for the IWW called Joe Hill had a really well-known saying called "Don't mourn, organise," and that is something that I think the IWW uses as kind of a building block, because the problem is with the legal routes and everything, it's all about appeasement, reaching compromise, everything like that. Organising is about much more than that, right? As we were saying earlier, the law and knowledge of it is only going to take you so far. After that, you need an organised workplace and you need strength among your fellow workers, right? There's no definite definition of organising or no one way of doing it, and it's got to be an organic process that changes with circumstances and everything and keeps moving, basically. And that you need to be aware that it's organising, not recruitment. There's a very big difference. Because recruitment, that's just signing people up to the union, okay? That's one thing. And that, okay, that has its own strengths and everything. You know, at least you're getting people on the books, as it were, and at least, you know, you're opening their minds to more, okay? But organising is about much more than that. Organising is about building an awareness of what the union stands for, building an awareness of why we're fighting, building an awareness of the issues, building a knowledge of how to do it. Okay, everyone is an organizer, right? Regardless of, you know, whether they're choir or whether they're gobby or whatever. Yeah, I always go. this is something that I do wrong very often. Like, if I'm trying to organise somewhere, and when we've been to other pieces of us to try and go, I just look for the gobbiest person and think, right, they're going to start it off. But that can be a good way of doing it, because a gobby person is good at getting it going. But they're not, what you often find is they're not good at maintaining it. Mm. Okay? So the gobby person.
Or speak to management either.
Yeah, exactly.
Because
yeah.
That's how I'm giving that as well. You've got all gone higher, yeah.
It can be an issue. So yeah, maybe if you're organising a workplace, look for that gobby person and get them doing the recruiting. Maybe, you know, getting people signed up, just shoving application forms in front of people and telling them to sign it, right? But that quiet person that you might ignore might actually be the person who keeps the whole thing going. It might be the best person in there to be a rep for everyone else, and might encourage people in the long term to get involved. You know, so. That's what I mean when I say everyone is an organiser, right? And you want to work along these lines of finding an issue, taking action and educating on it, okay? When you're organising somewhere, it really helps to have an issue as a focus, because just organising people for the sake of organising is quite a circular idea, and it doesn't have... It's much more difficult. You can do it, by all means, you know, you can organise the workplace just so you're ready for something if it happens, and it is possible to do that. It's just a lot harder. But if you can organise around an issue and say, right, we're getting treated unfairly, we're getting shit pay, working in unsafe conditions, we need to organise so we can do something about that, right? Talk about taking action and educate people on the problem, right? That needs to be the focus, right? So what we tend to say is, like I was saying to a few people earlier, the TUC organising guide is a good place to start. But that's what it is, it's a good place to start. Don't use it as a building block or anything. Use it for ideas, because it is very limited and it does. It is based around mainstream trade unionism as a model. Okay, so it is based around the idea that you've got full-time officials that you can pass things on to about building workplace committees and stuff like that. But as I do, as hopefully we'll get time to go on to, building workplace committees isn't necessarily a bad thing. It can be a positive thing, and it can be the start of actually building a union branch in your workplace, because it can get people used to that sort of that workplace democracy, you know, which is an important thing as well. Getting people used to the idea of, you know, we need to vote on stuff, you need to have it approved by everyone at work, and you know, it's all about a process of getting people used to that as a standard practice. All right. What you're always saying is you've got to choose the right target, okay? If you're organising from outside a workplace as someone who has seen workers in a particular workplace being treated really badly and you want to do something about it, then brilliant, nice one. So what you want to find out is what is, as a rule of thumb, you want to say, what's the objective of running a campaign there? You know, why are you doing that? You want to know 100%, you've got to... Like I was saying about having an issue, you've got to know that issue back to front. And really importantly, you've got to do your research. If you're going to run a campaign in a company that you don't work for, or even one you work for, know that company in and out. Know how many people it employs, know how much money it makes, know how much profit it makes. Really importantly, know how much your manager gets paid. Know how much their manager gets paid. Know how much the guy who runs the company gets paid. You know this stuff. That's got to be. You've got to know that stuff back and front, right? Trying to skip through some stuff, so we can, right. Okay. So what we want to do is we want to look at the thing. It's called PIP, right? It's PIP and SWAT. Okay, PIP stands for. I've forgotten what the I is. Here's an M. Sorry about this. Ah, there you go. Right, problem, information, plan. Information, that was it. Right, so what's the issue? Like I was saying, what's the issue? What's the problem? Identify the issues, whom they affect, and why. Okay? And how, sorry. Consider what you can do and whether you need outside help. So is this something you can do on your own, or is this something you can get other people involved in, right? What information do you need? What research do you need to do? And what resources are you going to need to achieve your aims, okay? And then make a plan. It's really important that you make a plan. And in a way, it's good to be disciplined as well. Stick to that plan. Be willing to revisit it by all means, but stick to it. Okay. If you say, and something we've had as a problem is we've said, right, okay, on this day we're going to go out and we're going to go to other shops and we're going to try and get them involved. And then if that slips behind, well, then the problem is then you might not come back to it. And it's a really important issue that you've got to keep on pushing for. So try and make a plan and try and stick to it. Okay. The reason I wanted to do with that is because, right, what we're going to do is a bit of an activity for people who are cool with it. I know we're running short of time, but I think it's good to try and do some stuff before we have to shoot off. It's just in pairs or in small groups if you want. Using that kind of PIP idea, think about either your workplace or someone else's workplace and talk about something, how you could develop it, how you could look at a problem at your workplace or someone else's. What information you need and what plan you can make and some ideas. Alright, so remember to look at the work involved and what would be a realistic outcome as well. That's something that's always important. By all means, promise the demise of capitalism, you know, by all means promise the start, promise your boss's head on a platter, by all means, but be aware that you need to have realistic outcomes. And most importantly, you need to win something. No matter how small, even if it's like a kettle in your team room, it's something that you can show as go, well, look, at least we got this. You know, no matter how small it is, you need to remember that you need to come out with something to show for it. Nothing destroys an organised workplace, like losing time after time after time, alright? Always set yourself a realistic outcome, because if you don't, all the hard work that you put into organising your workplace and getting all your fellow workers riled up about stuff is just going to peter away, everyone's going to be disenfranchised and you're going to lose a lot. So realistic outcomes are the key, right? So do we want to do that? Do we want to just break off quickly and just do that? I mean, I don't know what time we've got. I mean, actually, yeah, it's already quarter past. We don't really have time. Sorry. Yeah, I'm just looking at how squash we are for time. Right. Okay. Yeah. We'll have a discussion of one of these instead. Just. Actually, you know what? I think we should probably wrap up. Yeah. But yeah. Nice one. Sorry to rush through everything.
People
are
going to speak to us at the
store. Yeah, we're going to be at the stall for the rest of the day. If anyone wants to ask any questions or discuss anything, we'll be there. And like I say, if anyone wants this booklet as well, give us your email and I've got your email.
Yeah.
But yeah, and we'll send it out and everyone can have that.
Cheers.
Nice one. Cheers. Thank you.